Hey everyone, this is Alan, one of the co-hosts of Peaks Chats. We're really excited to be rewatching Twin Peaks and discussing it here on the podcast, and we want to make our spoiler policy up top very clear so that folks who haven't watched the series before won't have anything spoiled for them. If at any point in our main discussion we bring up spoilers at all, they'll be cut right out of the episode with a seamless edit. And if you have watched Twin Peaks as well as the film Fire Walk With Me, you can hear those cut segments after the plug zone and the 30-second musical outro. Otherwise, feel free to stop your podcast after that outro and you should be good. We likely won't be spoiling the return much at all until we get to it because Magellan has actually not seen the back half of it, but if we somehow do feel the urge to talk about it, we'll mention that up top as well. With that in mind, please enjoy Peace Chats.
Two by fours, four by eights.
Did you hear me? You can't do that to my workers. Don't walk away from me like that.
Come on back here. You're not going anywhere and you're not going to tell anybody anything.
Catherine, I'm sorry if this offends you, but I'm the owner of the sawmill.
And you don't know the first thing about this mill. That's why I'm running it.
I've never taken this authority before, but maybe I should have.
You're not shutting us down.
Catherine, I have the final say-so. Peter, push the plug.
Pete, don't you dare.
Catherine, please. Shorty, tell the boys to pull the plug. That's right.
Welcome to Chats, a television podcast, season 12, Peaks Chats. My name is Magellan, and they're a policeman's dream. It's Alan.
Now wait just a second, Mr. Man. You always call me these funny things, and do I want to be a policeman's dream? I mean, in the context of the show that we're talking about, the answer is yes. But that's what makes this universe a little askew from our own.
Yeah, that's the wackiest thing about Twin Peaks is that the cops are likable. These cops are bastards. Yeah, exactly.
True.
We're also joined this episode this week by a special guest, and he still can't get the taste of fish-filtered coffee out of his mouth. It's best friend of the pod, Jim. What's up, Jim?
Hey, howdy, hey.
Hey, howdy, hey. Welcome. Thanks for joining us for the first episode of our 12th season of Chats, a Television Podcast.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, it's a delight. So for folks who are new to our program, we are a television rewatch, but really a lot of the time we're a first watch podcast where we pick a show and watch it two episodes a week and just go through it and discuss it, close read it together. And this time around, we're going to be covering the program Twin Peaks. So that's going to be pretty exciting. We're going to be getting into a discussion of season one, episode one of Twin Peaks today, which is called Pilot. It was directed by David Lynch, written by Lynch as well as Mark Frost. It aired for the first time on April 8th of 1990. Alan, what happens in the pilot of Twin Peaks?
Quite a few things, but to summarize, in this episode, the date is Friday, February 24th, 1989. In the town of Twin Peaks, Washington, a man named Pete Martell discovers a young woman, Laura Palmer, dead and wrapped in plastic near his usual fishing spot. As the news ripples out across the town, we are introduced to our assorted cast of interesting characters. The local lumber mill gets shut down for the day. The students in Laura's high school grieve their best friend. And Agent Dale Cooper is brought on the scene to investigate the related murder of Renette Pulaski. Since this murder occurred on state lines, it is now an FBI case. And as the investigation is underway, everyone in town seems to be hiding something. And Cooper is here to stay for the foreseeable future.
Nice.
Wow.
So, I talked at the beginning just a moment ago about how a lot of the time when we pick shows, we're watching them for the first time. But longtime listeners of the podcast will know that this is not mine and Alan's first time watching Twin Peaks. We actually watched it just before we started recording our very first season of Chats, which was on Farscape, as a kind of dry run, I guess, of watching a show and talking about it in the way that we do on this show. So, Alan, do you want to speak a little bit more to that and in our context with Twin Peaks?
Yeah, absolutely. Similar to how I was about to start Buffy before contacting Magellan. I had been interested in Twin Peaks, I think like early college, late high school. And I thought it was a really interesting show from what I heard. And, you know, it's super influential and important to the history of television and how, you know, event television has come to exist in the present day. So I attempted watching it when it first hit Netflix at that point and bounced off of this pilot, partly because it's very long. And if you don't know what to expect, it can come off as a little bit boring, honestly. Obviously, in my second and like third viewings of it, I think this is a riveting, amazing pilot. But I bounced off of it. And then I think it was a couple years later that the now defunct Idle Thumbs Network released their Twin Peaks Rewatch podcast, where two of their hosts watched through all of the show. And I brought Magellan on and listened to that as we watched it together all the way through. And then I watched The Return as it was airing week to week, which was an incredible experience. And yeah, I'm now a super big David Lynch fan, and Twin Peaks is up there as one of my faves. Nice. What about you?
Yeah, pretty similar story, obviously, since we watched the show together. But I fell off of The Return. So when we get to Twin Peaks The Return later in this season, I will be viewing a lot of that with fresh eyes. I think I only watched maybe a third of it or a half of it at most, just because it was annoying to access it with the Showtime website and all that stuff when it was coming out. But Jim, you have not seen Twin Peaks before. Is that correct?
That is correct. Yeah, I'm the fresh eyes for hire here. Yeah. I'll say I have kind of a partial knowledge of Twin Peaks just because it was super pervasive in the cultural landscape for a long time. So I know things about Twin Peaks, such as the love of coffee, right? The thing that always kind of made me bounce off was the fact that it just seemed so 90s. So that's part of the reason why I never really got into it. But excuse me for this one, but I did read a David Foster Wallace essay about David Lynch, and they talked a lot about that's a sentence and a half. And they talked a lot about Twin Peaks and David Lynch as kind of a creator in general. And so that's kind of my familiarity, which is to say passing, but I know of a lot of the works that Lynch has put up.
Gotcha. Very cool. So let's, I guess, talk about the Twin Peaks pilot holistically. What were your impressions, Jim, of the pilot? Did you enjoy it? Did you not enjoy it? I'm curious about that.
Yeah, so I think, and I'll get into this later, but I think that this is a really good tone piece. I'm not quite as sold on it as a cohesive story, but I think just in terms of setting up an atmosphere and setting up like a set of bizarre events that happen, it's a really interesting universe that's kind of created. And it almost seems to me like it's populated by a bunch of Nicolas Cages. it just feels like everyone's got that energy going on.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, that was sort of what I was reflecting on in watching this. Really, Twin Peaks is, I mean, I think people are probably familiar with the pitch of Twin Peaks, which is that it's a murder mystery cop show meets a soap opera meets David Lynch's influence kind of peeking its way into random moments. But yeah, I was really curious watching it now. I think this is the second time I've seen the pilot, or maybe the third, thinking about how people received it at the time. Did people view it as a whodunit murder mystery where there's an answer to who the killer is? And it seems like, yeah, kind of they did view it that way. But ultimately, it seems like the most enjoyment you can get out of the Twin Peaks pilot is if you enjoy little things like, for example, the way that Pete Martell lets Sheriff Truman know that
she's dead, wrapped in plastic. And like,
if you enjoy that sort of delivery, then you love Twin Peaks. And if that just like doesn't register for you, then I don't know. I don't know what the show is, you know?
Yeah. I think it reads, if you don't care about that kind of stuff, as a bog standard murder mystery, at least this early on, because of this pilot, really, it's brilliant because it holds so much close to the belt. Knowing, you know, how strange the series gets and how creative and special it is to me. It's like, I watch this pilot, I just think, wow, they, like, you could just watch this and it feels like every other small town murder mystery show. It's, mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a little askew and everybody acts a little weirdly and there is, like, weirdness on the fringe of it. But it's honestly a good one of those. If I were to watch this with absolutely no knowledge of anything else about Twin Peaks or David Lynch, I would say, yeah, I liked this. I thought this was pretty good, one of these. Not like remarkable or special, but, you know, what I think works, and it's one of the first things in my notes, was just that we never, like, Twin Peaks as a setting is established so very well. Between the discussion of nature here, mm-hmm. and the politics of the town and all the different iconic set pieces, I think where it excels in the ways that shows that we're influenced by it do not, is I feel like Twin Peaks is a real place. It's a real town. These are people who have known each other for very long, and obviously they're not going to reveal every secret about themselves because they've known each other and they have no reason to say out loud what these secrets are. I think it just like it lures you in with that appealing, this like Pacific Northwest chill vibe, like even right at that theme song, that iconic Angelo Badalamenti theme song. I feel like, oh, I'm here to stay. I'm here for a relaxing stay in a nice town. I love that.
I'm curious about, I want to dig into something you just said, Alan, about something Twin Peaks does well that shows after it don't do as well. Because when I was watching this and reading about how people were receiving it at the time, there was a ton of buzz around the premiere of Twin Peaks. There were magazines that were publishing articles even before this released saying this is going to change the way that we watch television, or this is a revolutionary moment. And we know that essentially all of television after Twin Peaks, all of like prestige drama television, it draws on Twin Peaks in some way. So I'm curious what both of you thought in watching this, like, did you feel like you were just watching something where it's like, okay, I've seen all of this done later in other places, or are there still things that are fresh in Twin Peaks, even revisiting it now, you know, 30 years after it premiered?
Jim, I think I'm actually really curious where you come from here as someone who has not seen this, like what you feel like this show is borrowing from, or where what was borrowed from this show specifically?
I think in some ways I don't even know that I'd be able to fully list things mm-hmm. because I think that when something becomes so ingrained in pop culture, it has a way of just becoming the normal. It's the standard by which everything mm-hmm. else is measured, which means that structurally speaking, it did feel kind of contemporary, but the things mm-hmm. that I do notice are the places where it does stand out, specifically like these hyper acting styles, right? This it's like not even mired in realism necessarily. So I don't know that I'd be able to specifically point out how similar it is to usual prestige television, mm-hmm. Just because I think this is the standard, at least for mm-hmm. the shows that I've seen.
Yeah.
I mean, I've watched a little bit of stuff like The Killing. I watched back in the day, Riverdale. I recently finished the Netflix series Dark. Just literally the concept, small town murder mystery, it's a genre of itself at this point. I think it gives you a lot of opportunities to build character relationships and also to obscure reveals until later dates, because it's like, well, like I said earlier, these people already know each other. Nobody's meeting each other for the first time except Cooper to everyone else. So like the first, whatever, 30 minutes of this pilot before he's even in the episode are awesome, because it's like, these people just hang out. This is just what a day in their life looks like and what the grieving process looks like for them. It's pretty sad. It's pretty quiet and mundane, but it reels you in before we even have our audience substitute. And I think that that's like the thing that, like I said earlier, those shows just don't get, because so many of them are like really bleak. And I read a quote a long time ago from David Lynch, and I need to pull it up before we finish this season, because it's a great quote, where he was basically saying like, he grew up in a lot of small towns in the Midwest. David Lynch did, in the Pacific Northwest, I mean. And he felt that he would see things and see people interacting with each other in ways that he couldn't possibly, he never saw anywhere else. Like, he moved in, when he went to the city, when he went to Los Angeles, he was like, the people in Montana, where he was born, act and do specific weird quirky things that no one else does. And he really wanted to capture that feeling of like, this is completely unique. No one else is ever going to say this combination of words or react like this ever again. And I think he's always been like pushing for that feeling in all of his work, whether it's his more horror-based stuff or just his more mundane stuff like the beginning of Twin Peaks.
Yeah, and I think it's, to me, when I was watching this, the thing that was setting it apart from the shows that come later is what both of you are saying, that it just has a this sort of sense of humor where it makes sure that whenever there's a moment of drama, there's something about it that's funny or off or strange, or it's immediately followed or preceded by a character acting in a quirky way. And it's not the kind of like way that we might see it happen in a, I don't know, a show like Buffy the Vampire Slayer, for example, where it's offsetting horror with like quippiness, because there's not really much quippiness going on in Twin Peaks. Maybe sometimes there are certain characters who say clever things or funny things, and it comes off that way. But more often, there's just like what you're describing, Alan, like an oddness to how certain people speak or how they interact with the moments of like horror that surround them. And I can't think of another show that really does that in the same way.
It's so freaking hard. I mean, that's why most of them go for the realistic, like, well, discovering a murder is really depressing and mundane in a way. But Twin Peaks, like you're saying, it's just like, yeah, but also like these people are weird and life goes on. And sometimes you still have to talk about like your land deal or there's like just character dynamics that exist. It just feels so lived in a way that I can't possibly describe with another show doing.
You know, I think in a weird way that actually makes this seem a lot more realistic, because we're given this kind of standard of realism, which is to say, like, there is a standard called realism, which doesn't necessarily bear any sort of resemblance to actual reality, right? Like, we're told about what cop shows should be like how dark and gritty they should be. And I think that this, in a weird way, like, captures the, like, I don't know, it's almost like a human incompatibility with horror, I guess, is how I'd frame it.
Interesting.
Where, essentially, like, when something terrible happens, people do go to work the next day. Because, like, I don't know what else to do. Like, I'm gonna go to work, right? Like, and so I feel like in a weird way, like, these kind of bizarre interactions, they are kind of capturing not only this quaintness in these northwestern towns, but it's also capturing something that's like, yeah, distinctly human about the way that people deal with tragedies.
Yeah, one of my favorite moments in the episode, like little moments that exemplifies that, I think, is when Cooper is looking at the tape that they find later of Laura Palmer with Donna and they're, you know, hanging out in the woods or by the mountain or whatever. And he zooms, he pauses it at a part where it's zoomed in on Laura's eye, and there's a motorcycle in the background, and he's showing it to Sheriff Truman and to Lucy, who works at the police station, to be like, oh, we're trying to find a biker. And their reaction is this.
Looks like a hog to me. Holy smoke.
Holy smoke.
It's just like so goofy, but it's exactly that thing of like, what else are you supposed to say? You're just
cool.
Shocked. You're wow. Like, holy smoke.
It's like when we saw, we watched The Stand as our previous season, and there's a really horrible, there's a really horrible moment, like of violence at the end in the fourth episode, where somebody like jumps off of a building, and we found it so interesting that the first thing that they cut to is a woman going, whoa, which is like, what would happen?
Yeah.
But the context is key here, because in The Stand, this is a heightened story of like good and evil and like the magic that controls reality. And so far, at least, Twin Peaks is still in this realistic sense of like, yeah, what the hell else do you say? Like, literally, I'm like, we could just cut to them and or show them like looking shocked, but these are people from the Pacific Northwest who don't or aren't used to this kind of thing. This is a case that's outside of their bounds. That's why Cooper is here. Mm-hmm. So they say, holy smoke.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I think there's a lot to be said for, you know, people talk about Twin Peaks as like David Lynch's work. And you have to give credit to Mark Frost.
Oh, yeah.
And
big time.
For a lot of it. But there's also just certain ways that David Lynch's directorial style is also lending to this particular tone, and like just his sensibility towards being a director. Because Alan, there was a moment that you wanted us to grab in the coroner's office.
Yeah,
I don't know if you want to explain that.
So some of my favorite stuff in Twin Peaks is when it feels like like surreal, actually. Or rather, just so real that it's creepy. Or so. Cooper, FBI agent Dale Cooper, and Truman are in they're in the autopsy room looking at Laura's body, and they're like talking about the fluorescent lights, which aren't working for no reason other than it's hella creepy that they are like broken fluorescent lights that are just flickering. Love that. And then he tries asking the coroner to leave.
You leave us, please, Jim. Would you leave us alone, please? Oh, certainly.
Just, you would never, 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 never would you write in a script that somebody misheard something. That never happens. I've never seen in my life.
And the thing is, both of those details, I was looking at the trivia, and the flickering lights, they were just broken.
That's so good.
And David Lynch is like, yeah, that looks cool. Keep it. And the part where the guy says, Jim, he legitimately thought that Kyle MacLachlan was asking him what his name is. And
oh,
that's
my
just
God.
The guy saying that. And David Lynch is like, that's perfect. Keep it. That's exactly what I want.
Absolutely amazing. Another great example of those, I have a lot of them noted, and I don't want to just like go down the list, but one of my favorites that I always think about is when we first see the school with that like red line painted across the school for some reason. It's part of their like motif or whatever, but it's very creepy. There's just a shot where they're like freaking out, like Bobby's being asked to go to the principal's office, and as we're about to cut away, there's just a kid who moonwalks away from his locker and off to the side of the screen. Why did we keep that? It's so good.
That's funny.
Remarkably good. And it has nothing to do with anything. I feel like David Lynch like understands the key, the like basic 101 rules of screenwriting, but he realizes that it's often more interesting to break them and be like, yeah, people can just say things that don't mean anything. And what the effect that it has on me is I watch this and I can't like dig into it the way I would a normal mystery show. Or like a book where it feels like, okay, every line has to be intentional and meaningful, and this is all hinting at something huge. And it's like, honestly, a lot of it is just like people being strange in a small town. And you just kind of have to accept that and stop looking for secrets. Because the show will reveal the secrets when it's time.
I totally agree with you. But I think that my interpretation of that is that because everything is so like deeply mysterious, but you don't know what matters, like it simultaneously feels, as you were saying, you should just put this aside, we'll process this later, but it also feels like you're right on the cusp of uncovering something huge, but also right. you don't know like whether anything is reliable, which I think is so cool to have for a detective show. Because I don't know, the idea that everything is like simultaneously weird and out of place, but also like that's just this town. This is like yeah. how people interact. Like the number of times I saw someone act in a way that I would normally say seems kind of guilty, you know, the principal right, sobbing right. when introducing this, right? The dad's reaction, right? Like there are so many like guilty seeming people, but no, that's just how everyone is in Twin Peaks.
Right. When Sheriff Truman and the other police officers go to the library and they're like interrogating Bobby, and then he has this whole like, "What, you think I did it? I loved her. She loved me. Come on." And he's like, you know, trying to shake them off him and stuff. I was like, you killed her, man. And like, that's just the thing that comes to my head because of the way he's acting. But you're right that I can definitely see why people at the time would have latched on to details of the show and like formed a sort of cult, you know, sensibility around it of like, oh, we have to figure out what's going on because everything seems so charged. In the show,
it begs you not to overanalyze it, though. It's like it feels like maybe we can talk about, you know, this was such a important show culturally, and people wanted to solve this murder. You know, who killed Laura Palmer was yeah. like this phrase that echoed through the 90s. But a lot of it just feels like, okay, be patient. David Lynch is gonna and Mark Frost are going to tell you a tale over the course of however many episodes, and it's a network television show, so that gets kind of goofed up along the way. But like. You're just here to be here. We could tell you who killed him in like 5 seconds and you'd be like, okay, and you could move on from that. But it's so much more interesting to like dig way deeper into the interiority of everyone and why they could kill her and what they're hiding specifically, that I find that so much more interesting than the core question of who killed Laura Palmer. Even before I knew who it was just like, oh, I want to know what Bobby's deal really is more than I want to know who killed Laura Palmer.
Do you think, though, that like when you and I first watched it, I don't even remember. Do you think that we also were like, oh, who killed her, though? I feel like it's such a seductive question that you can't help but ask it.
Yeah, and it definitely like there are aspects of the show that are pointing you to like, can you guess who it is? Like a whodunit in a way. Because Cooper's trying to do it, but like they also portray Cooper as so hyper competent. Like there's a difference, right? Between I think they're called locked door mysteries, like mysteries that you can or cannot solve yourself as the viewer. But to me, this one feels like a closed door mystery. Like Cooper is the one who can solve this. I don't have the information I need to solve it. So I try to like
right.
look at everybody freaking out and reacting, but then he just says something or he just writes on the calculator like Bobby didn't do it. And I'm like, I'm deleting my notes. Like, all right, shit. Okay, he couldn't. Damn it. I guess he didn't.
He just like opens her diary and finds a little baggie with a key and some cocaine in it. And it's like, okay,
what the fuck?
I couldn't have done that. You like create evidence out of thin air.
Yeah, absolutely. So he just has
the
answer.
In the eyes.
Yeah, right.
Which is hilarious. I think that one brings me to my last big point about like overall Twin Peaks thoughts, which is that the reason a lot of millennials latch onto this show is it's so analog in like a really charming, appealing way. I mean, from the fact that the central export of this town is lumber, to the fact that Cooper records his findings into a tape recorder, and just like the physicality of everything, like Lucy directing the phone so that Truman can hear it on the other end. Like it's really, really interested in like the little technical details of how these things happen and like, make sure you put out an APB. What does putting out an APB look like? Well, it's this. And what is like digging in an autopsy look like? Well, it zooms so far into like the minutia of what investigating a murder looks like, tactical in a tactile way that I think a lot of people of our generation find that like really appealing as we've like transitioned away from this analog generation.
There are definitely moments of like, there's this moment later in the episode where Lucy's calling Truman while they're on the stakeout.
Go ahead, Lucy, patch him through.
I'm gonna patch him through to you now, Sheriff. I'm patching you through now, Dr. Hayward.
Why? Why?
And I love the little moments like that. Yeah.
Do we want to talk about the moment-to-moment stuff now?
Yeah, that sounds good to me. I think the only thing that, or maybe we talked about it a little bit, but I think the other huge creative force here defining the vibe and tone of the show is the music.
Oh, God, yeah.
And the music,
I wanted to bring that up, yeah.
The music, like, carries certain moments, and I can't imagine what Twin Peaks would be if the score was not the way that it is.
I really like that. There, towards the beginning, there's this, like, really grating beeping noise that I think really kind of sells this idea that something is out of place, and things that seem nice and normal, just like this typical interaction, or typical sets of interactions, they're just like, that grating, beeping kind of background noise is just like so present, and it really does set the world into a really kind of negative, like dystopian almost vibe, which is I felt like that really, really sold the tone.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Yeah, there is horror and weirdness on the fringe, like I said earlier, of the show with the sound work that does a lot of that. But yeah, Angelo Badalamenti wrote most of the music for this series, including the iconic theme song, which comes up as a leitmotif in the show. And there's also this, like, I don't know the name of it. I should look up the name of it. But there's another leitmotif that's used like 15 times in this pilot. It's it gets kind of absurd. It's not a big soundtrack, but it's a good soundtrack is what I'll say.
Right. And then there are also moments like another one of my favorite moments in the episode is Audrey Horne is in the hotel and she decides that she wants to mess with her dad's business deal with all these Norwegians.
Yeah.
And the cinematography and the music hand in hand, along with her performance, are working to make it so clear to you that this is like a surreal, strange place. Because the camera is like zoomed a little too far out and looking at things from a weird angle. And then she's telling the Norwegian business people about Laura's death. And this is the music that's going on in the background.
Excuse me. Is there something wrong, young pretty girl?
He found my friend Laura. Lying face down on a rocky beach.
It's just like bum, 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 bum,
bum, bum, bum, bum, bum. It's like when the cartoon does like the big character and every time they take a step it's a tuba. It's the same like energy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's carnival music.
Yeah, I think that does it do a great job. Like if you just took that exact clip and recut it with some like dark synthy music or whatever, you'd be like, this is so sad and horrifying. But now you're like, oh, she's taking the piss a little bit. Like the music really, it's a character of itself.
Yeah. And you know, when we get into characters, if we want to talk about individual characters, I think there are some actors who like get it a little bit more than other actors. And Sherilyn Fenn is someone who gets what's going on. And so she's doing a great job in that scene. Whereas I think there are other actors who are like too normal. We'll talk about that. But yeah, should we talk about the plot breakdown of the episode?
Sure. I promised myself that I wouldn't English class this too much, but I was like, I took a film class in college where they made one of the ideas that they drilled into our heads was the first shot of any series or movie is the most important one, the first and last, whatever. And I forgot that the freaking first shot of Twin Peaks, after obviously all the nature stuff and like, look at this beautiful town, is Josie looking in the mirror at herself and humming. And then we go right to Pete Martell. But the choice to start on somebody looking at themselves in a mirror, if I'm going to like overanalyze it, really gives you this sense of like, what is this person hiding? What are they looking at that we're not seeing? What are they thinking that we're not? Because she's also like a little distraught. And we learn later that's in part because she's running the risk of being bought out. But like this anxiety on her face that we just want to be in to understand is so much of the show. It's so much of it is like, hey, this person's saying something but they mean something else and they know something else. Sometimes that's obvious and corny and sometimes it's like brilliantly subtle. I thought that was so great to start on that.
Yeah, and I think it communicates you know, the obsession that every character in the show has with like their image and the way they're outwardly perceived and how pretty much every character is constantly conscious of it because everybody is like having sex with somebody they shouldn't be, or, you know, hiding some sort of shady business interaction or something like that. And not to reveal too much, but I think there's also something interesting about the idea of like someone's reflection. You know what I'm saying?
I do.
Like what that sort of like presages about later images or characters in the show.
Mm-hmm. And mirrors in general are like a recurring motif. Lots of mirrors. But we get introduced to some characters. I think as we talk about them, we can kind of like say our general thoughts on the characters. I think that's the best way to do both a character and a plot breakdown. Josie is a mess. It's a problem the way that they handle this character. So she's the widow of Mr. What's the last name of the person Packard. Who owns the? Yeah, so she's Josie Packard. Her husband died and quote brought her from Hong Kong to America, where she learned English and became his wife, and now owns the lumber mill that is like the key export of Twin Peaks, Washington. She is the only Asian character in the series at the moment. And the show exoticizes her beauty in a way that's really weird, but also like Lynch does this a lot. And obviously there is the context of like the way that the obsession with in culture with over-sexualizing Asian women, but also just like that part doesn't even define her that well. At least at this moment, it's just like, oh, she's beautiful and she looks different. Like she's othered by the way that she looks. I don't think the show knows what to do with that, though. I don't think it's like equipped to be like, oh, what does it mean to be the one Asian woman in a town in the Northwest? It's just like, that's just a detail that's placed on her and she doesn't really have much to do with it. Are we interested in seeing the sawmill plot? Majal, I know in your notes you were like, ugh, the sawmill.
Before I answer that, I actually have something, a thought on what you just said. Mm-hmm. Because I think what's troubling about the way that Josie is portrayed is like other characters make it clear that they are quirky based on their behavior. And with Josie, it's like before she even behaves in any sort of way, the camera is looking at her as if she is different or doesn't belong or something like that. And so I agree with you, you know, about what's troublesome about her portrayal there. I think a weird wrinkle, trivia wise, to just throw into it is that initially the character of Josie Packard was written as an Italian woman who was supposed to be played by Isabella Rossellini.
Whoa.
Who was romantically involved with David Lynch at the time. And she was in Blue Velvet. And in Blue Velvet, she's exoticized in a very similar way to Josie Packard. So I think rather than that kind of smoothing out the Asian American part of it, it just like broadens the problematic ways in which David Lynch exoticizes women. And but that's just something I learned that I was like, okay, that makes sense to me that was the original.
That you could just swap that out. I mean, Joan Chen is a great actress. I think that she's not given much in the show, but she's great. And yes, this is a Lynch thing. Being a fan of David Lynch means you also have to accept occasional quirks like this, unfortunately, with race and with women, of course. Which is fascinating because there's a lot of like great feminist reads of some of his work too. Like I think even our Audrey as a feminist character exerts more control than you would expect from your usual like 90s teen sitcom girl.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So we have Josie and we have Pete going outside and in that beautifully shot moment where he sees the bag. Why is Laura wrapped in plastic? We're probably going to find out. I love the introduction of the different police office nerds. We've got Andy, who's just a lovable man who does nothing wrong and cries when he sees a dead body. We have Dr. Hayward, who is so sweet and so empathetic in that like hometown way of like, oh, this guy just cares about people. He's so nice. He's never done anything bad in his life. We have Harry Truman, who... the goat. Why do they call him Harry S. Truman?
It's great.
It's another one of those things that you're like, do I want to read into this? And the show's like, no, dude, it's because it's the president. It's so that Cooper can go, that's an easy name to remember, and that's it. That's yeah, the extent right. of it.
Right. I feel like all of these characters are, to some extent, with the police officers in general, like, I feel like to some extent they are just like, okay, this is a complete whole human being, but also here is the like the one line description of who they are. Oh, this is Andy. He's the one who cries. Here's Harry S. Truman. He's right. the one with a president name. Like, yeah. It's yeah, like there's just such a weird characterization that I think is actually kind of charming in this case, where it's like it's just this one dude who his thing is that he just cries. I don't know what to tell you. That's like his entire character right now.
That is an interesting way to think about Twin Peaks characters, that they sort of like bounce between being completely one-dimensional and very deeply like emotional and having an interiority to them, almost scene to scene. That seems to happen. Yeah.
Everybody's a cartoon sketch outline until they're not, right?
Right.
And I think that's what makes it easy to get into, is you're like, oh, that's all I need to know about Truman. And then later, when you learn that he's in love with Josie or whatever, that they have a thing going on, you're like, wait, whoa, he was just like the guy with the president's name earlier. Now he's this. Like, building on your pre-established notions of who these people are is what Twin Peaks does best, I think. Also setting mood and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we start just like hearing different people realizing that Laura's dead. We meet both of her parents, Leland and Sarah. Leland played so charismatically, I guess, by Ray Wise. A fascinating character. And the fact that I forgot that him and Ben Horn are like pals. Benjamin Horn is definitely like a chat's favorite. One of the best like weird characters on this show. We don't get a lot of his weirdness here. He's just kind of like a shrewd businessman.
There is one quick moment, if I could just play it, where for no reason he hawks a loogie into the fireplace. And
please.
It sounds like this.
It's so gross.
It's so crunchy. Gross.
I don't know why that was in there. It's disgusting.
Like, did they just... How many takes was that?
I don't know, but they picked this one. Just one more time for you. Yuck.
Oh, it's with the nose at the beginning too. That's the best part of it. Yuck. One thing I didn't realize about Sarah Palmer early on is that she's a relentlessly anxious person before Laura is dead. Like, I always in my head imagine Sarah Palmer as this woman who's just like, oh, my daughter died and now I'm like quote unquote hysterical, and like how bad it is to portray a woman like that. But like, she's chain smoking the minute she finds out her daughter is missing. She's anxious for other reasons. She's just like is like this, and she wasn't ready. This was like I think it's a Friday, like I said at the beginning, and she's just hanging out, and then they're like, oh, your daughter's dead, and she's like, I cannot even process this at all. She goes straight to hysterical crying and whatnot. But we don't see too much of Leland or her just yet. Before we go to the Double R Diner, one of my favorite sets from this show, we meet very briefly. We see Heidi, underrated waitress character who has a funny accent and giggles. That's her whole character for the whole show. she has a funny accent. Her name is Heidi and she giggles. Love her. Bobby.
There are some random characters who, if you're watching this for the first time, you're like, oh, okay, that's going to be another character who we learn more about later, but they're not. Like Bobby's blonde friend guy, who's, I guess, is dating
Snake.
His name is also Mike. No,
that's how Bobby
refers to him.
Refers to him. He calls him Snake. Yeah, I assume that this dude was going to be huge.
No, he's like nobody. I don't think he comes back much.
I'm not remembering if he comes back later, but at least, right now he's just Bobby's like left hand.
Right.
But we have Bobby and Mike. Bobby is just like, I love because the police, like when they interrogate him later, we learn a lot about like his daily routine. He's like, I go for a run at 5 a.m. and then I get breakfast at the Double R before I skip class and don't go to school. Like, he's just that kind of guy right away. And he plays a song on the jukebox before leaving with Shelley, and it's like not even like a cool song. It's like kind of wacky and weird. It's another one of those things.
Aria.
Yeah,
it's a really weird song, and I feel like that's also one of those kind of bizarre soundtrack choices that really, really works.
Yeah. What it implies is that he was just like, this is weird. Like, if I played, like, What's New Pussycat on a jukebox and then ran out the door. Like, same thing, where he's just like, ha, enjoy this, guys. They also kind of, like, make him seem like he's the portrait of sexual magnetism here, where Shelley leaves with him, and then she's like, oh, Norma in there. She probably also wants to screw you. He's like, does she know about us? And she's like, no, I think she just wants to bang you, Bobby. And he's like, that's pretty cool, I guess. I think all of his sexual energy is captured in his, is it the Gen Z side part or the middle part?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, he's definitely an e-boy. And Gen Z
icon. Wow. Bobby Twin Peaks e-boy fanfic, when? but then we go to, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, can I read one of the notes that I took down?
Please.
It says, Bobby is the worst. And this is just immediately off the bat. He just, some light spoilers. I'm going to be bringing up other people who I think are in competition to be the worst later on.
I'm very curious to hear that.
Yeah, Bobby, I think that they did a great job of characterizing him as just like the pits, just like this over-sexualized, is
trash boy
appropriate here? Trash boy, yeah.
Himbo is more of a lovable thing. He's not a fuck boy.
Oh, I see. Yeah, no, this... Sorry?
He was more of a fuck boy.
Yeah. I see. Okay, right. Two C's. Yeah, so that's Bobby, ugh, God. And, we'll get to some stuff later on. But yeah, I just wanted to pop in there and say that Bobby is the worst at this point.
That's totally fair.
Currently in the running for the worst, yeah.
Yeah.
But we go to the school where we see a bunch of other weird characters. We meet James. Jim, before I say anything about James, what's your read on him in terms of like worst person ranking? He's the motorcycle boy with the spiky hair and the huge forehead.
Yeah. James kind of seems
blank.
As a James, I have to say, James. He's a blank. He's just a blank right now. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't particularly get why he was the one that anyone loved or was romantically attached to, because he just kind of seems like, I guess the nearest equivalent would be like painting a wall egg colored, you know?
Why is he my boy James like that?
I mean, maybe he gets better later on, but...
No disrespect to Kyle MacLachlan and to this guy, but... The guy who plays James and Kyle MacLachlan were cast for a similar reason, I think, which is you take a handsome face and you kind of smush it and kind of stretch it in places. And now it's like still a handsome face, but there's something a little bit different about it. And I think Kyle MacLachlan, you know, is a phenomenal actor and like knows how to make that work for him, and the guy who plays James is not quite as self-aware of his whole situation, I don't think.
Why do they focus so much on his stupid forehead? Why? Like, he's like looking at Donna as she's crying, and he's supposed to be like, I'm angry and distraught, but he like tilts his head down in a way that makes it just completely call attention to this guy's big freaking forehead. I could not stop looking at that, and I was like, they chose to keep this in here. Speaking of like weird background things, the detail that while they're freaking out about this, there's just a girl who runs outside across the yard and goes and just screams. What's that?
During this whole scene, by the way, the principal, if I could just play a bit of his performance, I think he is the standout side character who doesn't come back, who like really gets what he's supposed to be doing.
I am dismissing all classes for the day, but before we leave, I would like to ask each of you to join me in a moment of silence for Laura and her dear memory.
Just the way that he's like, a moment of silence.
So silence.
For Laura's dear memory.
He is bringing the right energy to it. Yeah. But yeah, they find out that that Laura is dead and everybody... A lot of this episode really is just like, hey, people are reacting to Laura being dead. Like, that's why I totally understand it. Someone was like, this is boring. We don't really have action necessarily. Right. Even, but well, once Cooper's in here, it's really exciting.
Can I just say about the police officer who comes into the classroom? Like, I know that this isn't the point, but it really bothers me that he doesn't even try to take the teacher out of the room while he's, like, talking about this girl's death. That just struck me as very, like, very irresponsible. And I know that, you know, with everything else going on in this, that's probably not what I should fixate on. But for whatever reason, that just bothered me that he wouldn't even, like, take the teacher outside. That isn't really related to anything. It's just another weird choice, but one that logistically just feels kind of awkward.
I would argue that the protocol, not them not knowing how to do protocol in this town, makes sense, because like this has happened like 30 years ago. It was the 1980s when Teresa Banks happened, so like most young people in this town do not know what you do when there's a murder. So I think that part kind of works, that they're like, oh, yeah, this is handled super awkwardly because they do not know the steps for it. But I agree that part's that detail is a little strange. Do we want to take it to a brief break before we talk about the second half of this episode?
Sure.
All right.
Sounds great.
We'll be right back after this brief break to talk about the second half of the Twin Peaks pilot.
Diane, 7:09 p.m. The end of a historically hot week in North America. The other day I received an emergency message from New York City that said the following, and I quote, "Emergency alert! Conserve energy. NYC is urging all households and businesses to immediately limit energy use to prevent power outages as the intense heat continues. Please avoid the use of energy-intensive appliances such as washers, dryers, and microwaves. Limit unnecessary use of air conditioning." Now, Diane, I didn't understand what could be unnecessary use of air conditioning, so I left my air conditioner on. I also fought the heat with food, some delicious vanilla bean ice cream. And today, on a slightly cooler day, I've cooked myself Szechuan broccoli and mushroom stir fry with cashews and buttery ginger rice. The recipe called for sugar. I didn't have sugar, so I opted with no sugar. The recipe called for butter. I didn't have butter, and so no butter is present in the final product. As you can hear, Diane, I'm bringing you closer to the pan with the stir-fried ingredients themselves. Here we have some broccoli, mushroom, cashew, and of course the sauce. Now, Diane, before I put this over rice, I'm going to grab a fork and take a quick taste. The sauce, Diane, is bitter. Could definitely use some sugar. But otherwise, damn good mushroom. Damn good mushroom. Well, Diane, that's all I have for you now, but I'll be in touch soon as this situation develops.
Diane, 8:40 p.m., July 3rd. Quite the day we've had today. I've found myself somewhere in the suburbs of Massachusetts, nearby to the city of Boston. Nothing but rain today, Diane. As Oscar Wilde once said, when it rains, look for rainbows. The coffee this morning was a bit sharp, but invigorating. Lots to do, and plenty of time up here in the burbs, Diane. Lunch today was a toasted bagel with scrambled eggs and American cheese on top. It was my only meal so far, and it was a satisfying one. Everything bagel, brown eggs, olive oil butter. If you ever get a chance to try a bagel, egg, and cheese at home, Diane, make sure you butter that bagel. It'll be worth it. Now I'm off to find that rainbow. We'll talk soon.
Welcome back, folks. It's Peak Chats. We're still here. We're still talking about the Twin Peaks pilot, which also is known as Northwest Passage, by the way. I didn't mention that, but that's the alternate title for this episode. I want to get to the introduction of the best character, Agent Dale Cooper, coming up. But we, like I mentioned, we had some more school stuff. We have this great scene where Bobby is interrogated in the library by Officer Hawk, I believe. We don't get his name just yet, but Michael Horace playing Hawk as this like kind of stoic, pretty cool dude. I like Hawk a lot. I he's obviously super underutilized and is another example of Lynch just like casting for, I think he like cast him as like, we want a Native American police officer. It adds to the like weirdness of the show. I think that that's what you, as we learn more about like the world and what's going on, I think that that gets muddied up a little bit. But right now he's just another one of the cool guys. He works with Truman and I like him a lot. I did like how Bobby just like instantly super reacts when they're like, did you kill her, Bobby? And he's like, no, why would I ever? Oh, I didn't mention this briefly. Cool thing when we see Sarah Palmer in the house and she's like freaking out. We get this like shot of the stairs. I love the stairs in the Palmer household. They're so weirdly creepy the way that they're shot from the bottom upwards. I think there's just a lot of like, we talk about how the music has so much character to it. Often where they place the camera in a scene in the series is like, oh, what's going on there? Why are these like suburban stairs so creepy? I don't understand it. There's just like the creepiness underneath the mundane is really clear there. But anyways, Bobby and Shelley freak out because they realize that there's a truck parked there's the whole Bobby interrogation scene. One note I had here was that like the show just isn't, it's just not as weird as it's stereotyped as being just yet. And I don't even know how quickly it gets there. But I really did watch this and just think, oh, this is just what happens when a murder occurs in a small town. There's nothing to it. I thought that was just really clever and creative. But less creative is this, the introduction of the sawmill plot line. Josie, for the sake of this murder, has the sawmill shut down so that people can go home and grieve with their families. I understand it. It doesn't seem like a very practical thing to do, though, because sometimes people want to work through their grief, right? But it makes us think that Josie is a pretty empathetic person who wants people to like feel things and not just work through their problems.
Right. But which then immediately makes us wonder, what is she actually? What's her ulterior motive here?
Yeah. Cause her sister-in-law hates her and wants her to not shut it down. And then this is another one of those, like, why'd you keep this? She says, push the plug. And then somebody picks up the phone and goes, yeah, pull the plug. And it's like, wait, why did she say push? Why did you keep the line where she said push the plug? I don't understand. David. So then you might be wondering to yourself, well, Alan, Magellan, and Jim, this is a small town murder. Why does an FBI agent have to come here? And I thought it was really clever that we then see the death of Renette Pulaski, which happened on state lines, which is the reason that the FBI can get involved. So we get the introduction of our protagonist of the series, FBI agent Dale Cooper. Dale Cooper, played elegantly by Kyle MacLachlan. And as he's introduced here, he's talking into a tape recorder to a woman named Diane.
Diane, 11:30 a.m., February 24th. Entering the town of Twin Peaks. 5 miles south of the Canadian border, 12 miles west of the state line. Never seen so many trees in my life. As W.C. Fields would say, I'd rather be here than Philadelphia. 54 degrees on a slightly overcast day. Weatherman said rain. You get paid that kind of money for being wrong 60% of the time. You'd be working. The mileage is 79,345. Gauge is on reserve. Riding on fumes here. I got to tank up when I get into town. Remind me to tell you how much that is. Lunch was $6.31 at the Lamplighter Inn. That's on Highway 2 near Lewis Fork. That was tuna fish sandwich on whole wheat, slice of cherry pie, and a cup of coffee. Damn good food.
I had to keep the clip all the way to damn good food.
$6.
How much the lunch was.
$6 for coffee, a sandwich, and a slice of pie. Are you joking? I love this. I hate inflation.
Yeah.
The moment when he comes on the screen and enters the story is so electric. It's because you feel like you're getting a vibe from Twin Peaks and you're like, okay, this is kind of interesting. But without Dale Cooper, it would not be able to sustain my interest, I don't think. And then he carries the whole show on his back into that moment. And it's like, this is what it is. It's kind of all of that, you know, subtle stuff, But it's also just Dale Cooper being like, yeah, I really like the trees around here, and I wish I knew what they were called. And man, the cherry pie is so delicious. It's like, this guy is bizarre.
Yeah, it's like weird because he's the viewer substitute, but he's also one of the weirdest characters on the show.
Yeah, right.
So
right.
You're like, I'm supposed to relate to you, but you're weird too. And sometimes you're weird in different, completely different ways.
I really like that he has a stand-up. Like, it feels like he's working on a stand-up, like a tight five.
Yeah.
With the whole, like, Weatherman thing. Like, wow. It feels like a combination of, like, the sort of thing that you'd hear in, like, if you're talking to your barber, right? And your barber saying, like, Weatherman got it wrong again, huh? It feels like, and that's such a, I think part of the reason why it feels like he's so out of place is everything else is dark and gritty, and everyone's like, you know, having this you know, morbid kind of time processing death, and he's just like, he's just busting down the door with an electric guitar. I love that.
Right And he's like, I think the thing that's interesting about what he does for the story is he's this weird mix of very interpersonally charismatic and also super detached from the realities of what's going on.
Mm-hmm.
Like he's the opposite of Andy in the sense that he's not at all fazed in any way by death or by what's going on. And he kind of has this like gleeful fascination with the mystery and with finding details that I think also shifts the tone of the show a bit.
Right. Yeah. I love that Harry embraces it. Like, their friendship is one of the nicest things about the show, because early on Cooper is like, hey, whenever the FBI comes in to investigate a small town murder, the cops and the sheriff, whatever, tend to push back really hard on that. Can you please like assist me and like let me kind of take charge here? Cause that's what I need to do my work. I don't mean it like to undermine you or anything. And Harry's like, yeah, sure, you're the boss. We got you here for a reason. There's no conflict like that between them. And when Cooper is weird and analyzes things weirdly, Truman can't help but just smile at it. He's just like, this guy is different than us, and I don't have a problem with that. I don't think he's not like a stuck in the mud, like, you know, a boomer old guy who's like, ugh, this new guy doesn't get it. There's just not that kind of conflict in here, which I really love.
Yeah, and they end up having like delightful little exchanges. Like, there's a moment towards the end of the episode where they're staking things out. They see Donna get on a motorcycle with some mysterious motorcycle guy, and they say,
suppose you want me to follow them at a discreet distance.
Harry, you're all right.
It's just like little moments of affection between them are very fun.
I'm not going to say I ship them, because I actually do support like tender male friendships that are not romantic in nature, but I kind of ship that like a little bit. There's a lot of people who are like that ship Cooper with like the different women on the show, which I think is gross because a lot of them are teens, and the ones who are adults are all in committed relationships. So
well, that doesn't really seem to be that much of a problem for this show.
Not in Twin Peaks, no.
No, they're all in two committed relationships.
I think I counted something along the lines of like five or six different sets of like cheating or, you know, whatever the, you know, sneaking around behind someone else's back of some variety, which I thought was kind of remarkable for one episode. It seems like right now everyone's deep, dark secret is that, yes, they are sleeping with someone else. Like, it feels like as a random sampling, right, you could just like guess that someone's deep, dark secret was that they were cheating on their partner, and you would be kind of correct in Twin Peaks.
yeah, definitely. Yeah, because who you have, Bobby is with Shelley, cheating with Shelley, and Bobby was with Laura, Shelley's with Leo. Then there's Norma and Ed.
But Ed is with Nadine.
Right. There's Josie and
Truman.
Sheriff Truman, which I guess neither of them is with someone, but they're being secretive about it.
Yeah.
There's Laura and James.
James right now, yeah.
And there's James and Norma.
And kind of. Donna,
sorry.
Yeah. At the end of the episode, they like start to make out in the car.
Yeah.
Which, by the way, I wish I'd clipped this moment, but where they're like making out and she's like, oh, James. And he's like, oh, I'm sorry. And then there, no time passes and he says, I'm not sorry anymore. Start kissing. And it's so silly.
James is a legend. I've been saying that.
Yeah, James was always cool.
Mm-hmm. Then we get, so we get some more, both Donna, who I like a lot. People are always like, Donna or Audrey, and or Aubrey. Aubrey or Audrey? We should answer Audrey. This question. Audrey. Okay. And while I do think that, like, Audrey has a fun character to her, that she, like, is, clearly comes from money, and wears a lot of makeup for her age, and is, like, kind of a miscreant. There's that hilarious scene where she pokes the hole in her mom's cup of coffee and then goes, what happens when I take it out and spills coffee on her mom's desk? So funny.
Can I read you my note that I wrote at this point?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mm-hmm. Please.
It says, is she now Audrey the worst? Also sucks.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then she goes, she sucks in a fun way. Meeting. Yeah, yeah, I don't know. I like, it seems like she just loves the wanton destruction, right? Just like chaos for the sake of chaos, which... yeah, like I mean, it's certainly different than Bobby's style of being the worst, but it is definitely, like, very, I don't know, I hate the thoughtlessness and, like, callous destruction. Yeah. And so, like, Audrey, right now, in contention for being the worst.
That's valid. I actually, to come to my, back to my original point, which was, like, Audrey versus Donna, I think I like Donna more. I think I actually personally find her, like, a more appealing person. Romantically, I would date her.
Well, but do you find her more interesting as a character, though?
No, Donna's, like, not doing anything yet, except crying a lot and sneaking out of her house.
Yeah.
But what I love about the teens in this show is, you know, Majel and I have talked before, and I feel like this season is such a good time to bring it back up, but we both went to the same high school. Actually, the three of us went to the same high school. And we always had this, like, paranoia that, like, all of the cool kids in school were, like, out doing crazy things, like drinking and having sex after school. And a lot of times that wasn't true, but, like, Twin Peaks kind of imagines a world where that's exactly true. Because, like, as soon as it hits 9 o'clock, it's, like, all the adults go to this, like, go to the roadhouse. Some of the teens go there, and some of them, like, do cocaine in the woods, and you're like, whoa! Like, this show is the manifestation of, I think, that anxiety that I always had about my own high school, about our own high school. So I just find that really funny, especially, like, as this episode transitions into nighttime, I like that this pilot kind of, like, courses over a whole day. When Cooper leaves for the night from the police office, he says it's 12:38 a.m. and everything before that seems to be, like, in the early morning, into the afternoon, and now into the evening, because, like, the lighting is consistent across the episode too. You can kind of tell where we're at. But before we get to all that stuff, I really wanted to touch on Audrey's brother Johnny. Speaking of, like, hey, what's going on, David Lynch?
Yeah, I forgot about this.
Yeah,
so, me too. Johnny, like, has a disability of some sort, and we see him, the only thing he does in this episode is he hits his head against the dollhouse over and over again, and I think there's nothing going on here. I think this is just weird.
But also dressed as a Native American too.
Yeah. Speaking of, like, the hawk stuff, and then speaking of Johnny, like, I think David Lynch just has an association of, like, small town equals also Native American heritage stuff.
And I mean, that is a reality of the Pacific Northwest. Like, yeah. I've been in small towns in Oregon where there's just, like, you know, wooden sculptures of Native American people outside of cigar shops or something like that.
Heck,
like,
yeah.
That is a thing. But it is still strange, to see that happen in this episode and not have it addressed and have it just be kind of like a part of the set dressing or the scenery along with whatever it is that's going on with Johnny. Is that his name?
Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just like I don't know, an uncomfy scene overall.
Yeah. I think that really does seem to show its age. Just like that is, I mean, it's really one of those things that ages so, so poorly. And I was also very uncomfortable with that scene.
Yeah.
Well, what's a bummer, right, is, you know, there's a Vulture article called, like, Why Twin Peaks is Not the Wonderful Series We Remember It As Being. I think I might be getting that wrong, but I'll look it up later. And a lot of it talks about Johnny, and it's like, oh, you guys, don't people remember how like weird and the offensive and racist this show was? And it does get worse with its portrayal of disabled people later, big time. But like, and I promise not to talk about The Return too much until we get there. I really do. The Return has some like boldly very progressive things in it that are like startling that they came from the same minds as this show. But I guess like people change, times change. And yeah, sometimes you have to keep up with the world
of life, right?
Yeah. And I think that David Lynch just like started to get past these things, but not entirely. So it's like weird. And it's definitely disappointing to see this Johnny stuff and just be like, oh, that's set dressing is what you're saying that is, you know? But it's a big bummer. And we get some more stuff with the Norwegians briefly. There's a Norwegian group of people. I believe there's a great moment when they're heading out and you hear the woman at the reception desk saying,
the Norwegians are leaving. Yeah. The Norwegians are leaving.
Why?
I love the Norwegians. If they're only bit characters, I'm going to be so disappointed. I want them to be in every episode.
Right. Yeah.
You'll have to watch to find out. But yeah, the Norwegians are basically there as part of a deal with Ben Horn and with Leland Palmer to buy some part of the land or something for a development project. And then we're going to learn a lot about that. That's another one of those plot lines that you can either take or leave. But it mostly works on Ben Horn.
All the like property sawmill stuff is very soap opera-y in a way that I'm not interested in at all. Like the intricate web of like this person's with this person, but they're with that person. Like I'm like here for, and you know, I'm sucked up in the drama of that. Even when it's terrible moments, like when Leo is talking to Shelley and he's like, why are there two brands of cigarettes in the ashtray? Even that stuff, I'm like, oh no, he's gonna find out. But the sawmill stuff, I don't care.
Do we have much to say about Leo? I don't like he, that's literally one scene.
He just sucks. Awful. He's just like an abusive boyfriend guy, husband guy who sucks. I don't know what else there is to him.
I have a question. Does Bobby know that Leo is with Susanna? Shelley? What's her name?
Shelley. I believe he does, yes.
Yeah, that's why he was freaked out when they were driving up and Leo's truck was there.
Yeah, when they see the summer truck, they're like, oh shit, it's Leo. Dad.
I think she said, like, she might have said dad, or she said something that could be interpreted as dad or, like, my man or my old man or something like that.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't remember, but she was talking about Leo.
Okay, I see.
She said it. I think, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, she definitely was talking about him, but I see. So Bobby might know that Leo is, I mean, he seemed appropriately freaked out.
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
I find Shelley confusing because she's not a teenager, right? Like, she doesn't go to the high school with them.
Oh, is she not?
I don't think so. I think she just looks like she's the same age as everybody else because everybody is like an adult playing a teenager. But I think she's supposed to be a slightly older character. Yeah, and also, she's also not related to Norma, even though they look super related to each other. It's confusing.
Wow, I never thought about that. Yeah. Wait, when does this episode take place again? 80 something? 89?
89, I think.
Yeah. She's 20.
Yeah, she's like fresh out of high school, I think.
Okay. Or yeah, that's interesting. And yeah, her Leo is at this point in the show her husband.
Yeah.
So yeah, he's terrible to her. He's like just an abusive piece of crap. We're not supposed to like him. You're never going to like him. The actor playing him is too good at. It's like it's sort of like how Joffrey, the guy who played Joffrey Baratheon on Game of Thrones, like people like hated him. Eric Dore is eerily good at me wanting to punch him in the face, making me want to punch him in the face. Which is it's a talent, right? But anyway, so there's that stuff. And then we transition into the evening and everybody's going out doing their sneaky things. I believe it's Donna who sneaks out of her house and we meet her sister, Harriet, who I love. Harriet's just another one of those like, what's going on with you, girl? What do you got going on? She's just writing poetry and asks for like what the best word is for her poem. I love Harriet. Mm-hmm. And then I had a question as we get into this nighttime stuff. So Lucy like responds to the dispatch, right? About like, let's do an all points bulletin about Donna. Mm-hmm. Does Lucy go home? Because I guess it's 9 o'clock and it's like she's been there all day. And if people call into the sheriff's office, she's the one who redirects them to different people. So yeah. Don't they have to have somebody there all the time in case there's like a crime at 4 a.m? I wonder how that works.
That's a good point.
I guess so, yeah.
Because in a small town, it's like, I don't think they have a redirect system and they don't call 911 because there's nobody nearby. So they just, I don't know what Lucy's hours are. I was worried about her. I was like, I hope she gets to go home. but then we get our last great set piece of the episode, which is the Roadhouse, our sort of like sketchy diner, bar, place where everybody hangs out after dark. And we get a vocal version of the Twin Peaks theme song, which is really good. I love this, the vibe of the Roadhouse. And this is like another one of my like big top favorite sets on Twin Peaks. And then there's like a big fight, like everybody gets into a fight over Donna and she's there and they're like, why are you here? And Bobby delivers the best line of the episode, which is,
my dad is the monkey wrench.
Dead.
And then there's this incredible scene where there's an all out brawl happening in the Roadhouse.
Yeah.
And that, the vocal version of the Twin Peaks theme song is still the soundtrack to it. And so it's just so, so dissonant and strange.
Love
and almost beautiful. It's like almost beautiful the way that they're just beating the shit out of each other.
Yeah, honestly.
Yeah.
And who's left in the sheriff's office but Truman and Cooper, who have like rows of donuts because Lucy has too much time on her hands and she's like, I got extra donuts for Cooper. And it's not even called attention to, but if you're looking, that's so many good background details on the show. There's like 40 donuts laid across this table.
Mm-hmm, and they're all stacked by type.
By
and
flavor.
Yeah. I like that. I think Cooper says that it's a police officer's dream.
Yeah.
Right. This spread, which.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Delicious. And then it ends with Truman recommending him the hotel that he's going to end up staying at. Mm-hmm. Another top tier set piece that we don't see in this one. And then the final moments of the episode, as people are like sneaking around in the woods, Mrs. Palmer has a scary dream of a gloved hand taking Bobby's half of the heart shaped locket out of the ground, which he buried it in. Because he has this locket with that Laura was supposed to have the other half of. Well, is that correct?
James has that.
I'm sorry, James. I always get James and Bobby mixed up. That's really bad. But yeah, James's half was buried, and then some mysterious gloved hand takes it out. Who could it be?
Yeah.
It's me. I did it. Sorry.
Pretty scary.
Yeah. So that's the Twin Peaks pilot. It's pretty riveting, honestly, to me. I do understand being put off by this, like the way I was the first time, because it's 90 minutes and it's a little bit slow paced. But I really think that they're doing a good job of seeding like this mystery and all these characters and the sort of quirky uniqueness of the town of Twin Peaks.
Alan, I think you might have forgotten one thing in your episode recap.
Oh, what is that?
You forgot about the log lady.
Oh. Who is that?
Who's the lady with the log?
We call her the log lady.
Thank you. That's so funny.
Truman, great character.
Yeah.
What do you think of the log lady, Jim?
You know, I have a suspicion that she might be the key to all this. It all pivots around the log lady. No, I mean, I think that's one of those examples of like it's so bizarre and so like jarring that you have to laugh. It's just so unexpected to be like, oh yeah, we're at a town meeting, right? And this is the log lady flipping the lights and telling everyone to shush. I loved that. I thought that was amazing, amazing like bit character work.
Yeah. Twin Peaks does such a good job of setting up little characters like that. And like I feel like we've already said it 1,000 times, but you're just like, I don't even need to know about you. You're just interesting. I love that you exist and they put you in the show. That's great.
Oh, yeah. I love Norma's dad. Norma's dad is so great. The doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Oh my God. What a good dad.
Oh, is that Donna's dad?
Oh, Donna's dad, not Norma. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Norma's the diner.
Norma's the older woman working in the diner. Yeah.
Yeah,
okay. There are a lot of names that are introduced in here. I apologize.
Yeah, that's okay.
But yeah,
Donna's dad.
Donna's dad. Donna's dad. Kind, kind
Doc man. Hayward, if you want. Doc Hayward.
Doc Hayward. Telling Donna to to put air in the back tire of the bicycle. Oh, what a sweetie.
Yeah. Well, that's a great moment of tenderness too, because like a murder just happened and they're talking about like, hey, take care of your kids. Make sure your kids like know that they're loved and appreciated so that this doesn't keep happening or whatever. And then his like thought is to genuinely be like, hi to my daughter. I love you and I'm happy that you're around. Uh-huh. And it's him being like, okay, I don't want this to happen again. Like what I know and what I understand. And he doesn't even freak out when he finds out that she's out of the house. He's like, please get her back. We're not going to make a big deal about this. We have a lot going on. Just like make sure my daughter is safe. Mm-hmm. Yeah, he has a world weariness that I love. Also played by Mark Frost's brother, I believe. Warren Frost, yeah. But yeah, do either of you have any like stray notes or things that you wanted to bring up briefly?
There was this random moment where Cooper has like a bunch of money in his hand and he says that's a lot of Girl Scout cookies, but Kyle MacLachlan says it weird. He says
it's a lot of Girl Scout cookies.
Girl Scout cookies.
Yeah. I don't know why he says it like that. That's a lot of Girl Scout cookies.
I think that's the key to everything. We're just going to keep saying that. Yeah. I think that is the key to everything.
Deep meaning in that. There was some like some trivia stuff that I wanted to talk about a little bit.
Yeah.
So I think we were talking about both of these things pre-recording, but in the intro sequence, they show the sign at the limits of Twin Peaks and they show the population, which is 51,201. And originally the population was supposed to be 5,120, but the network said that would just not be relatable for the town to be so small. So they basically multiplied the number by 10, but it doesn't make any sense because like the three of us grew up in a suburban town in Massachusetts that has a population of about 35,000-36,000. And so it would be less than what it says Twin Peaks is. And that's just not right. It's just so wrong based on what we see in the show. So
like maybe 10,000, I would say, okay, sure. I understand you're getting to that size because it's bigger than what we know. Yeah. But like the whole point is everybody knows each other. That's why it's a small town. And when you push it into 50,000, then it's like, I don't know, 90% of the people that live in the town that we grew up in. Like,
just a silly studio note to do that.
Yeah.
Maybe it's like, they have a really, really large retired population. And so they just have like off screen the entire time. There's just a senior housing development that contains like 49,000 individuals.
Yeah.
That's my explanation.
There you go. That works. Maybe all those Norwegians are contributing to the population. The kids in the high school class, by the way, were like very docile and nice to like
Magellan as a high school teacher was like, wait.
The word docile is maybe calm is the word I was looking for.
Yeah.
But yeah, it was just like, why is it so quiet in here?
Yeah. No one's like yelling or freaking out.
The other, Alan, maybe you want to talk about this a little bit, but I learned something about the distribution and alternate versions of the pilot this time that I did not know before, with the international version, if you want to talk about that maybe.
Yeah. So what Magellan's referring to is the international, what's now referred to as the international pilot of Twin Peaks. Which is a 94-minute version, so not much longer than this one. But it was basically intended to, like, wrap up the story a lot more tightly. So it has, like, extra stuff at the end that, like, answers who killed Laura Palmer in one episode. I've been recommended by multiple critics and heard about multiple people who say to stay the heck away from it because it's just really bad. I think it's on YouTube. It might have been taken out at this point, but you can watch it. Also, but like all of the added footage from it is recycled into episode 3. So there's going to be like some flashback stuff and cut stuff that's just going to come back. And they used most of the footage eventually. But the idea of trying to do this whole story in a 90-minute pilot or a 90-minute series just seems dicey to me. Like you could, Yeah, I think I'm curious about the international pilot. There's like a lot of Twin Peaks ephemera that I know about that I'm like, you know, I could read that book. There's like the Diary of Laura Palmer, but all of that stuff is like Mark Frost really likes the mystery lore, and I just don't need it. I don't need it. I've had friends who read that, and maybe we can have them on to talk about some of that stuff later, way later. But
yeah, that'd be cool.
I like Twin Peaks for what aired on ABC. You know, network interference disregarded. Obviously, I think the show that we got answers all the questions that you need answered.
Yeah, I think that's true.
But that's pretty much what I have, what we have, I think, about the Twin Peaks pilot. Quite a lot, quite a dense episode, like we said, but a really good one and a strong opening to a great series. So I think, Magellan, should we talk about what we're watching next time on Peaks Chats?
Sure, let's do that. So next time, this is going to be consistently confusing. So we're just going to use the like titles that the episodes got later, because since this was called Pilot, the next episode is called Episode 1, even though it's the second episode.
But they all also have like alternate titles, right?
Yeah, so we're just going to use those alternate titles. So next time we're going to be watching, I'm going to call them Episode 2 and Episode 3, Traces to Nowhere and Zen or the Skill to Catch a Killer. Traces to Nowhere, the summary says, Agent Cooper enjoys the comfort of the Great Northern Hotel. Bobby Briggs and Mike Nelson are released from jail. Dr. Hayward hands over the autopsy report on Laura Palmer. So just like stuff happens.
Things continue.
And then Zen or the Skill to Catch a Killer. Ben Horn's brother, Jerry, arrives in Twin Peaks. Ben and Jerry travel to One-Eyed Jack's and meet with its madame, Blackie O'Reilly. Audrey leaves a clue for Cooper. Deputy Hawk finds a bloody towel near the crime scene.
I think these hymns might be the secret to everything. fun stuff. Well, folks, I think it's time that we take it to the plug zone, if you're okay with that. First off, hey, everybody. Thanks for tuning in. If you have questions, comments, or feedback about Twin Peaks or Peaks Chats or any previous chat season, our email is chatspod@gmail.com. We have a Twitter at chatspod where we post when the new episodes go up, as well as a community-run subreddit over at r/chatspod where fans are re-listening to old chats episodes and discussing them, and it's really fun. We encourage folks to rate us on their podcast platform of choice, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify. We're on everything you can possibly think of. If we're not, let us know. And if you'd like to support us and help keep the show going, we have a Patreon over at patreon.com/chatspod. That's C-H-A-T-Z-P-O-D. And we have wonderful patrons over there. We have a patron exclusive Discord, and we are putting out all sorts of fun bonus content over there. Magellan, do you want to speak to a little bit of that while I pull up our $5 patrons to thank?
Sure. And I actually have our patrons pulled up, so I can also
thank them
if you'd like. So over on the Patreon, you can back us at $1, $3, or $5 a month. $1 a month gets you access to some random stuff in the backlog. It's mostly just your way of saying, hey, I want to help keep the lights on. Here's a buck, which we appreciate. $3 a month gets you access to everything. We do thrice monthly bonus content, two installments of what we call Chats Nights, which is sort of our hangout discussion, turn off the lights and chill kind of thing. And then a third episode, which could be us piloting a show. It could be us doing a commentary of a movie, whatever it is. And then $5 a month gives you the power to make suggestions for that third episode that'll get put on a wheel that we spin every month to decide what that episode is. And we have a bunch of folks backing us at $5 a month that we want to thank. So shout outs to Old as Your Omens, to Kat, to Marcus, to Nick and Pat, the brothers at Infinite War, to Fendon, to Ryan, to Six, and to Stefan. Those are our $5. And shout out to Jim here, who's a $3. Thanks, Jim, for supporting.
We love you with our whole hearts. Too. I'm happy to announce that we now have a website where you can access all things chats, past, present, and future. If you go to chatspod.com, you can see our wonderful website, which Magellan and I worked on tirelessly, and it has a list of chatsums, a list of seasons, funny bios for each of us for every season of chats. And it's just kind of like a well-produced little way to access everything like the Patreon and other plug stuff that we have. Our podcast art was done by the wonderful Camilla Franklin, who can be found everywhere on social media at Camilla Strator. That is CamillaStrator. Shout outs to Camilla. We love your art. Woo woo. We like to end every episode of Chats with a segment called Chat Sims, because instead of personal plugs, what we like to do is recommend things to people, because social media is a hellscape. We call them Chat Sims because it's named after Vlasic Snackums. They're little snacks for you to bite into between now and the next Chats episode. Jim, as our honorary guest of the episode, can you please start off with your Chat Sim for this week, please?
Yeah, I'd love to push this plug. And the plug that I'm pushing today is Cautionary Tales. Cautionary Tales is a it's a like an economics slash story podcast by Tim Harford, who is an economist slash storyteller. And it's wonderful. It's got two seasons currently out, and has things that tell you about economics through the means of like some really interesting tragedies that have happened.
Cautionary Tales, econ. I love it. I just took an econ class.
Ooh.
Megan, do you have a chat sim for us this week?
Yes, I do. This is a YouTube recommendation. There is this guy. He's a rapper by the name of Harry Mack, and he's an incredible freestyler, totally off the top, as they say. And he has a series of videos on his YouTube channel called Omegle Bars, where it's essentially him cutting together different performances that he's done for people on Omegle. They match randomly, they give him random words, and then he does a freestyle rap for them and cuts it together into these videos, which are really fun to watch. And if you happen to fall down the rabbit hole and you watch them all, and then you're like, I want to experience them again like new, I also have a recommendation of two reaction channels who have great reactions to those videos, if you get as deep into this hole as I am. One of them is goes by Youngblood Poetry, and he has this great like 40-minute analysis of Harry Mack's style and the composition of his freestyles. And then this other channel called That Singer Reactions, who's just a really funny, personable guy. And I enjoy his reactions and breakdowns a lot. So that's my kind of triple YouTube channel recommendation. Harry Mack, Youngblood Poetry, and That Singer Reactions.
Awesome. Damn, the triple threat.
Yeah.
And finally, my chat sum is a musician that I just discovered thanks to a friend from work. Her name is Lucy Dacis, the musician, not the friend, obviously. Although if Lucy Dacis wants to be friends with us, please chatspot@gmail.com. She's a singer. I guess I can describe her music as, you know, like Phoebe Bridgers, how she's like kind of got like that sad girl rock thing going on. What if like that, maybe not even that sad, just like melancholy in a way where you're like, I'm not even depressed. I just feel like it kind of like placid. It evens you out a little bit listening to Lucy Dacis. She has... I believe two full albums. One is called No Burden from 2016, which I listened to, and 2018's Historian, which I've been told is even better.
Yep, that's a great album.
Yeah. I listened to all of No Burden while I was out for a walk. It's like exactly a good walk length. And yeah, deeply just calming and satisfying music. And it has that thing that Magellan and I always talk about that we love when singers are really clearly spoken, and you can like memorize lyrics better and appreciate lyrics more because of the way that they speak. Also, she's like younger than I am, which makes me feel weird, but I feel like I say that about every other musician these days, and it's getting less weird. Sometimes you just make music, and that's okay. But yeah, Lucy Dacis, pretty great. Hey folks, that's what we have for you this week. Thank you, Jim, for joining us for the episode of the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you to Magellan for being the rock to my heart place. I might change that once we have more characters under our belt on this show. But for now, you're still the rock to my heart place. And thank you, dear listener, for listening to this episode of Peaks Chats. I need a sign-off phrase for this one. Like, I gotta have a sign-off phrase.
And that's...
Damn good podcast.
It was a damn good podcast. Damn good. Damn.
And I'm... gonna drink a gallon of coffee. creamed corn.
Thanks for listening. Whoa. Thanks for listening to Peaks Chats. I'm going to drink a gallon of coffee. That's not the one. I'm just being silly.
Okay.
Thank you for listening to Peaks Chats.
Who killed Laura Palmer?
Damn good show. Just say damn good show. I don't know. Something like that.
Damn good show. Which brings me to an interesting question I was going to say for the end, and I'll maybe ask you again. But, Jim, do you have predictions of who killed Laura Palmer? I think we should ask this to anybody who comes on the show as a first-timer.
Yeah, so I know who kills Laura Palmer. Is one of the things that I know. That is one of the things that has pervaded through pop culture to me. So I know stuff.
But
I'll refrain from saying much more, but
I'm sorry, I promise not to be this annoying ever again. But here's the thing. Do you know or do you actually know?
Right.
Do you actually know?
Spoiler warning for the next 2 minutes.
Yeah.
Okay. Jim, what do you know?
Do you think is the killer?
It's Bob, right?
Okay.
Yeah.
I love it. We should watch more Twin Peaks, Jim.
Wait, is it not?
It's more complicated.
Okay, wait. Also, isn't Leland Parker possessed by Bob?
Palmer. Okay, you got it. You're good.
Okay.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And then, yeah.
That's like the literal, but then, yeah, there's obviously like, you can have an interpretive discussion about that, but yeah, you know, basically.
Okay.
Yeah. That's just stuff that I know from, you know, pop culture, whatever. But yeah. So, anyways, that is who I know kills Laura Palmer. But
okay,
given the first episode, doesn't really seem like it.
Right.
I'll say that much.
Right.
Yes. Okay, we're back. Thank you. Indulging a spoiler warning, folks. I'll probably put like some honky alarms at the beginning and end of that.
Is it the same answer as to who did it?
Sort of.
Okay. Yeah. It's not as interesting, obviously, as the real answer. It's like kind of like,
Can we go into spoiler minute
again for a second? Hit the alarm again. Let me make a mark. Okay. Yep.
Spoiler minute. So in the international pilot version, it's Bob, and he's like a guy, and that's who it is, and they get help finding him and killing him, but like all the Leland stuff is not in it.
Like what? And then someone shoots Bob? Like what?
Yeah.
Dumb. Bad.
Yeah. That is kind of weird.
That concludes spoiler minute. Thank you for that. Let me make sure that's noted down so that nobody can hear that unless they want to hear that.